You're very welcome to open your Bible with me in Mark's Gospel, chapter 6. If you want to borrow a Bible from the shelf, you can. Just be warned that today, unusually, I'm reading from the version of the Bible known as the Message, just because I feel that Eugene Peterson got this one nearer where I was trying to get to as I studied it. So the Message version is on the screen, but there are the good old NIV versions on the shelves if you want to nip out of your seat now and grab one. So let's begin in Mark chapter 6 from verse 1. Jesus left there and went to his hometown. His disciples came along. On the Sabbath, he gave a lecture in the meeting place, that's the synagogue. He made a real hit, impressing everyone. "We had no idea he was this good," they said. "How did he get so wise all of a sudden, get such ability?" But in the next breath, they were cutting him down. "He's just a carpenter, Mary's boy. We've known him since he was a kid. We know his brothers, James, Justus, Jude, and Simon, and his sisters. Who does he think he is?" They tripped over what little they knew about him and fell sprawling, and they never got any further. Jesus told them, "A prophet has little honor in his hometown, among his relatives, on the streets he played in as a child." Jesus wasn't able to do much of anything there. He laid hands on a few sick people and healed them, that's all. He couldn't get over their stubbornness. He left and made a circuit of the other villages, teaching. And Jesus called the 12 to him and sent them out in pairs. He gave them authority and power to deal with the evil opposition. He sent them off with these instructions: "Don't think you need a lot of extra equipment for this. You are the equipment. No special appeal for funds. Keep it simple and no luxury inns. Get a modest place and be content there until you leave. If you're not welcomed, not listened to, quietly withdraw. Don't make a scene. Shrug your shoulders and be on your way." Then they were on the road. They preached with joyful urgency that life can be radically different. Right and left, they sent the demons packing. They brought wellness to the sick, anointing their bodies, healing their spirits. I was quite shocked recently. I'm easily shocked these days, I think. And somebody was reporting that they were trying to share their faith with a group of young people. And they mentioned Jesus, and one of the boys said, "Oh yeah, Jesus. Isn't he in the Bible?" He wasn't being funny. He was being honest, he's being sincere. He was perhaps even quite interested, but he had no idea of anything at all about Jesus. I suspect that that's quite common in many parts of the United Kingdom. We have a generation growing up that knows nothing about Jesus, really, or very little. And what little they do know about him is often as not wrong. And I come back to verse 3 in our chapter, where in Eugene Peterson's translation, he says, "They tripped over what little they knew about him and fell sprawling, and they never got any further." Now, that's not verse 3, is it? Whatever verse that is, unfortunately, Eugene Peterson's version doesn't have the Bible verses in, so I've no idea what verse that is. It must be about 4 or 5. Oh, yes. Okay. And, they tripped over him, and what little they knew about him, and fell sprawling. Oh, it's the NIV. Could you change it to the Message, please? It's just down the bottom there. It's the MSG. And Yeah. Otherwise, we're going to be seriously wrong. Okay? But we do have it on the projection. They tripped over what little they knew of him and fell sprawling, says Eugene Peterson. Really, pretty much X-ray of modern Britain, I think. So I just want to say a couple of things. First thing, you think you know about Jesus, but you don't really. God made us eternal beings. We are an eternal soul, each one of us, meant to live forever, meant to go beyond space and time. We have within us this extra thing that the animal kingdom, rest of the animal kingdom, does not have, this eternity of God. And he's made us eternal beings. But our eternal being, our eternal soul, our eternal nature has enemies. And there are things that work against our eternal soul, our eternal being. And one of the first things that works against our eternity, our eternal nature, is ignorance. And as a human race, that's a mighty problem. Nazareth was not a big place. It was I call it a one donkey town. It wasn't big. It was tucked up on the side of a hill, had a poor water supply. There were much bigger towns round about. It was a little village, really. It was the kind of place where you plug your electric shaving and the street lights would dim. And Jesus was brought up there. And he was brought up playing on the streets. He goes back there, and it really does not work out very well. Because though they know him, they're ignorant about him. They don't understand the significance of this man who they remember as a child. And I don't know what kind of family he was, what he came from, whether family was popular or not. But the Gospels are written like a sort of biography of in the ancient world. They're full of facts and names and incidental information, because that's the way the ancient people wrote their biography. It's not written as a myth. It's written as a story of somebody's life. And it's written with all the details of the eyewitness accounts, because eyewitness accounts were vital to ancient biography. So that's why it's written like that, because the disciples are saying, well, we were there and we saw it. And Mark's gospel is usually considered to be written mainly from the Apostle Peter's memories of the events. But Mark brings out like little teachings. You can tell that these were Mark's sermons when he preached. I almost get the feel of a preacher behind this. And Mark is like saying, you've missed out on the greatest event in history of planet Earth. You've missed out on the greatest. You people of Nazareth, Jesus, he was born there, he was brought up there, but you missed the whole point. You didn't get it. You didn't see it. It happened under your very noses. And you know what happened? What went wrong? You missed the point. You didn't get it. You didn't see what was going on around you. And various translations say they stumbled over him. Eugene Peterson says they tripped over him. Instead of Jesus taking them and molding them, instead of entrusting their eternal being, their eternal soul to Jesus, to follow him forever, they trip over him, they fall flat. Instead of him lifting them higher, they trip over and stumble and go lower. Instead of getting nearer to an eternity with him, they get further apart. And on Judgment Day, Mark is suggesting they're going to blame everyone but themselves But in truth, they've only got themselves to blame. And I have very little idea how Judgment Day will be. The Bible mentions it, but doesn't go into huge detail. But one thing I'm sure of, there'll be a lot of blaming everybody else on that day, or trying to. But what's wrong? It's their own thinking. They got it wrong. They completely misjudged it. They took a decision and they got it wrong. We've all done that. We've all looked back down our lives, and the older we get, the more we got to look back down, and we see, you know what? I took a wrong decision then. We have to see. One of my Facebook friends was bemoaning the vote, misusing his vote in the last recent election, and he wished he'd voted tactically now. But it's too late. Too late. The very candidate he didn't want to get in scraped in by just a few votes. And he and his friends say that he said, "We voted for the wrong party." You regret it now. But it's too late. And the people say, and again, if we go to verse 2 of this, we had no idea he was this good. We had no idea he was this good, they said. We didn't realize he was this good. But it's still not enough for them to believe in him. You have to ask, how good does he have to be for you to believe in him? Truth is, status was by and large fixed in the ancient world. Jesus had a humble birth, born into a carpenter's home, into a working man's family, learned the family trade himself, and grew up doing it. And there's a thing they say, this is Mary's boy, he's the son of Mary. They don't mention Joseph. We presume, we're almost certain by this time Joseph had died. But isn't there a bit of a dig here? They don't say he's Mary and Joseph's boy. They say he's Mary's boy. In other words, they're still doubting. There's still stories about Jesus' illegitimacy circulating around that village. So the family is kind of down there, you know. They're at the bottom level of society. And they're going to stay there. And so that's kind of behind their judgment of him. How did he get to be this good? Well, we don't know, but he's still the carpenter's son, that's all. He's not going to get any higher than being the carpenter's son. We're not going to let him. We remember him playing in the streets. We remember when he stubbed his toe and hopped all the way home crying to his mum. Oh, I don't know what stories they had, what memories they had of Jesus as a boy. But they remember all the stories they say now. He might be good. Probably, you see, he's actually the best teacher we've heard in our life. That sermon was the best sermon we've ever heard. But he's still just a carpenter's son. Don't get rising above your station, Sonny Jim. They won't accept. Won't see that he's more. And maybe it's darker than that. Maybe he's getting his power from somewhere other than God. Maybe there's a demonic power that's allowing him to heal. And we know his family. What a shower they were, maybe they're saying. They've all got stories about his brothers and sisters. Dick France says, it looks as though his visit to Nazareth was a short one. We do not know that he ever came back. Beware that your spiritual ignorance doesn't hold you back. I said we are an eternal soul. We were made for eternity. And the great thing about eternity is you've got forever to go deeper into God. Isn't that true? I mean, the little we know about God now is fascinating. We know that God's a Trinity, a three in one, an eternal dance of love. And we know that God is just a swirling, creating, loving power that just throws out wonderful creation. And we know he loves and he cares, but he's strict and he's demanding that we follow in his way. We know all this, but we know so little. And you've got eternity, to go deeper into God. And what limits us is our ignorance. We've got a whole eternity to take away that ignorance of God and his ways. But some people, they never get started. Their ignorance traps them in a world without God. And in the case of the people of Nazareth, their ignorance trapped them in a world without Jesus, because he doesn't look as if he ever went back there. They missed out. They missed out. They'd have had a blue plaque on the wall, wouldn't they? Jesus and others born here, and somebody would have gotten an open deck bus and done a conducted tour of the village. It'd been quite a quick tour, I think. And they'd had the souvenirs, the Jesus of Nazareth ashtray and the Jesus of Nazareth t-shirts, and they'd have had it all. They'd have done the full tourist thing. They didn't even get that. The village declined and disappeared in history. They missed out on everything. But at the heart, they missed out on getting closer to God because of their ignorance. Jesus, isn't he in the Bible? What you're missing? You don't know what you're missing. And eternal soul has other enemies, has our unbelief at heart. If we turn to verses 4 to 6, Jesus was amazed at their unbelief. He said, only in his hometown among his relatives and his own house is a prophet without honour. Actually, I was always extremely well treated by my home church when I started preaching, so I can't say it's true of me. My mother spent a whole time telling everyone how wonderful I was, which really didn't help. But Jesus could not do many miracles there. He was amazed at their lack of faith. Jesus is sometimes amazed at people's faith, usually foreigners. We'll come to that in a moment, in a few weeks. But here he's amazed at Jewish people's lack of faith. They should have known better. But they're not. They just got on the wrong path. They got into things that they shouldn't. They're filling life. They are eternal beings. They should be going deeper into God, and they're not. They're not. They're just stuck in space and time, not going beyond. Just wonder, fear, sometimes, if Jesus isn't amazed at my lack of faith, sometimes. Sometimes I'm amazed at my lack of faith. Inability to go deeper, to go further, to love Jesus more, spend more time with him in prayer, to study more. I have a huge capacity for getting diverted into other things. However, as a church, we support a little group of people in recovery from addiction, mostly all of them alcohol addictions. And Adveriad Troifi, the Recovery Through Faith, it's called. Celebrate Recovery is their theme. And I was just reading some of their literature, and it's really good. They have some rules. Be honest. Prioritize recovery meetings. Spend time daily with God. Get involved in serving other people. And keep in touch with your support team. I was reading that, and I thought, actually, that's a pretty pretty good set of rules for any Christian in their church, to be honest. To be in church regularly, be fed regularly, spend time daily with God, get involved in serving others, and keep in touch with your home group, with your church, with your pastoral care team, keep in touch with folk. It's not a bad rule for anybody, but you can see why it's important to them. But you know, we just get, we're rich, clever Christians, aren't we? And we have a lack of faith. We're over familiar with it all. We know it all, so we don't think there's any more to learn. In fact, we know very little. And we get into other things. We get obsessed with other things. Henrik Ibsen uses a metaphor of a hunting dog who relentlessly dives under the water for a duck that's falling in the weeds until the dog itself is in danger of drowning. And sometimes we get obsessed with things that actually aren't paying off in our life. And we just invest more and more time, go more and more into them. And they distract us from the real issue of getting closer to Jesus. We're like that dog. Frederick Buchner, in his spiritual autobiography, Now and Then, talks of an encounter with Agnes Sanford, a Christian healer. The most vivid image she presented, he writes, was of Jesus standing in church services all over Christendom with his hands tied behind his back and able to do any mighty works because the ministers who led the services either didn't expect him to do them or didn't dare ask him to do them. I think that's a powerful criticism. That's why we make a point of regularly having more open kind of services. Like next week, we're going to have a ministry zone. It's also Pentecost Sunday. So we're going to have a ministry zone just to come and pray, to allow the Spirit of God, just to say to God, yeah, you know what? You can disrupt our service. We don't mind. You can change things around. You can open the windows and let a gale blow through our building. We don't mind. You can work in our church, you can work in our midst, because we trust you. You won't do anything that harms us. So, if ignorance is one of the first enemies of our eternal soul, our eternal nature, then lack of faith, lack of belief that God is going to do anything special in our lives today is also wrong. God is going to do all kinds of special things in our life today and in our life tomorrow. But we probably don't realize that it's God doing it. We just drift through days if God hasn't sent the circumstances to meet us. So you have faith. You say, Peter, I hear you, but I do have faith. Well, now let's live it out. So now we move on to verses 7 to 8, where Jesus takes those who do have faith and says, okay, I'm going to push you way out of your comfort zone now. And he sends them out two by two. Because ultimately what people know about Jesus is it's going to be filtered through you and me, isn't it? A lot of what they know about Jesus is going to come through you. I'm sorry about that, but that's the way it is. It's going to come through you and me and the church. And the church's failures in modern society are out there in the tabloids, in the Sunday papers, and they're all over the web. So I don't need to go into it. When the church fails, the world fails to get hold of Jesus. And you might say, well, Peter, yeah, you said that that's not my branch of Christianity that's failed like that. And I say, well, would you like a list of your branch's failures down the years? Because everyone knows how the Christian church can fail. So Jesus sets out some principles here that are well worth following. The first is this. He says, listen, as you go out into a world of ignorance, a world of unbelief, first, be bold. It's interesting, he doesn't give up when he's rejected at Nazareth. Do you note that? I mean, I'd have gone away and sulked for weeks. But Mark doesn't say, he doesn't do that, you know. One of my friends was a door-to-door salesman. This guy couldn't believe it. selling encyclopedias. Didn't matter how many times the door shut on his face, he always believed that the next door would buy his encyclopedias. Fantastic guy, tremendous salesman. Any business would love to have this guy. Or if when he changed his job and began working from the office, every phone call he made, he was totally convinced the next phone call he'd make, he'd sell something. And Jesus says, be bold. He's rejected by his own town. He grew up. But he doesn't say, you know what? I'm going to take a gap here and go around the world on a trip. He doesn't say that. He says, no, I am going. Say what we're going to do. We're going to carry on. You guys, you're going to go out and you're going to do my work. Instead of just me, it's going to be the 12 of you, six pairs of two. We're going to increase our work by sixfold. You guys are going to do it. He's bold. Doesn't turn in on himself. Doesn't start feeling sorry for himself because he's been rejected. He believes that God is at work out there. And as he sends his disciples out into the villages, into the world, that God's going to go in front of them and going to start doing miracles. He believes it. But he lays down some principles. He begins by sending them out in pairs. He says, be cooperative. Don't go it alone. Support each other's witnesses. It's much better if you do this as a group. If you talk about what you're doing and do it together. And it makes you accountable. If there are two of you, you're accountable to somebody else. You're not meant to be lone mavericks going through the world as Christians. I call them free radicals. They're just Christians. They're not responsible to anybody, anything. They don't get on with people, so they don't fit into any... No church is good enough for them because they fall out with anyone there. And there's Anglesey, Gwynedd. I keep meeting these people. Which church you go to? Oh, I don't go to any church. Free radicals. Not accountable to anybody and frankly not doing anything worthwhile either. Be accountable. Be bold. And then he says this kind of blend in. Blend in. If we could go to maybe the Message version of this, Roger. Verses 7 and 8. He says, Eugene Peterson's version of this is, don't think you need a lot of extra equipment. You are the equipment. No special needs for funds. Keep it simple. And no luxury inns. Get a modest place and be content there until you leave. Blend in, he says. Blend in. Keep it simple. Simple clothes. Use sandals, not posh shoes. Simple clothes. Don't take huge bags with your wardrobe for your mission trip. Stay in humble accommodation. Don't go for the five-star hotels and try and work in that country. Were you as scandalized as I was by the American pastor who recently asked for $72 million so he could buy a new executive jet? Fly around the world? I'm not making this up. Trust me, I am not making this up. He wanted a new Gulfstream jet for $72 million so he could fly around the world and preach. And I was thinking, actually, you know, Christian Aid last year raised less than a quarter of that. And changed millions of lives around the world. And what you've done this week will have probably done about the same. Raised a quarter of that, and it will change so many lives. And I think, to be honest, maybe I'm ranting at this point. I don't know. I just don't like tourism. I'm not a huge fan. I like seeing places and so on. But, you know, tourism, I just find shallow. I'll be honest. Going to places and looking at things, but you never get close to the people. You never find what the people are actually thinking, what the local people are living. That's what I want to know when I go to these places. I want to know what they're thinking. I want to know what they use, what kind of stove they use to cook their dinner. I want to know what they have for breakfast. I want to know what their hopes are, their aspirations are, their dreams are. I want to know what frustrates them, what annoys them, what limits them. I want to know how they are as people. I want to know how they live as people in their homes. I just don't want them... I'm frustrated because I've only seen them in a uniform serving me in a hotel or driving the bus that I'm on. And yeah, the sights are beautiful, but it's not what I'm asking. I want to speak their language. I want to be able to talk to them in their own language. I just get frustrated by the whole tourism thing. It's okay, but it's not life. Do you know? It's not life. It's not real. It's a veneer. And Jesus says, don't go as a tourist into these villages. Don't go and stay in the posh hotel and just go down to preach and hand out a few leaflets. Go and get dirty. Go and walk the streets. Get the dust on your feet. Go and eat the food in a restaurant where the local people eat. Go and do that. Go get a taste of their cuisine. As Christians, we need to gain people's trust. And we won't do that by flashing a MasterCard in every direction. When we work in community, we end up working with transparency, integrity, vulnerability. Yes, vulnerability. We're not supposed to be autonomous. His disciples weren't supposed to take huge sums of money with them. They were just to trust that God would see them through from day to day. It's how we're supposed to be in church, just involved with people, ordinary people in an ordinary world. That's good. That's the best thing. That's the first requirement for being a great missionary, is to be an ordinary person in an ordinary world. It gets no better than that. That's the best place to start with. The world is not necessarily hostile. The world is not necessarily woefully ignorant. We can make it better, or we can make it worse. What did somebody say the last seven words of the church are? We've never done it this way before. Rick Warren, in his Down to Earth way, says, in order to catch fish, it helps to understand their habits, preference and swimming pattern. Successful fishers require an ability to think like a fish. I make no comment. There's some few ripe comments about fishermen at that point, I suppose you could make. I'm going to avoid that. I actually said to somebody this week, I'd go fishing with them. I've never gone fishing in my life, but guy's looking for somebody to go out on his boat with him. Well, yeah, I'll go fishing. Why did I say that? I've never gone fishing in my life. But here's the point. You know, I'll be useless at it because I have no idea how a fish thinks. I don't know what a fish likes. I'll just go as ballast to keep the boat stable, which is fine, which is good. Nothing wrong in that. But the point is, Jesus wants us to be immersed in our society, not to live above it, not to live beyond it, not to treat this world as our second home. Treat this world as the mission field that God sent us into, live into being, to adapt to it, to change into its shape. I came across a prayer, which I'm going to finish with. It's a Lutheran, written by a Lutheran pastor. And he says, it's like a conversation with God. The church is composed of people like me. And it's a very, very lovely prayer. So I'm going to finish with it. I'm going to ask the band at this point, if you join me, please, on the platform. But let's bow our heads and let's use this prayer to bring our thoughts together. Lord, your church is composed of people like me. I help make it what it is. It will be friendly if I am. Its pews will be filled if I help fill them. I will do great work. It will do great work if I work. It will make generous gifts to many causes if I am a generous giver. It will bring other people into its worship and fellowship if I invite and bring them. It will be a church where people grow in faith and serve you if I am open to such growth and service. Therefore, with your help, Lord, we shall dedicate ourselves to the task of being all the things you want your church to be. Amen.